Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests up today. First, in about 8 or 10 minutes, we'll hear from Monica Potts, an editor at the American Prospect, on how we're training people for green jobs that don't exist. On how we're training people for green jobs that don't exist, and why those jobs don't exist. And then at the bottom of the hour, another check-in with Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek economist I've been working really hard of late, on a better way to go about solving the financial crisis in the Eurozone in a humane, sensible way, instead of the current mad push for austerity and misery. Before that, some words in the news. The U.S. economy continues its stumbling recovery. On Thursday, we learned that first-time applications for unemployment insurance, filed by people who just lost their jobs, rose slightly last week after falling decently the previous week, a fall that exactly reversed the rise of the week before that. The four-week moving average, which smooths out weekly volatility in this series, fell by 4,000, but it's only slightly below where it was almost 2 months ago. In other words, it looks like the trend of modestly declining rates of job loss is continuing. But job loss, as measured by these initial claims, is still pretty high by historical standards, and there's not much evidence that employers are picking up the sluggish pace of hiring. Meanwhile, it looks like millions of people are going to lose their unemployment benefits, which, by the way, are a joint program of the federal government and the states. Normally, a jobless person can draw benefits for 26 weeks, but Congress often extends that period in times of high unemployment like this one. There have been a number of extensions of that 26-week limit since the recession hit, but no longer. House Republicans blocked attempts to extend emergency benefits, so nearly a million recipients are going to lose their benefits at the end of the year, and another million a month will suffer the same fate in early 2011. There's a ludicrous theory circulating among elites, meaning right-wing economists and some, though far from all, Federal Reserve officials, that our near 10% unemployment rate is not a reflection of a sick economy, but something called job skills mismatch. That is, there are jobs out there, but our unemployed workers are just too dumb or unqualified to do them. There's really no evidence for this proposition. Why did the number of mismatched roughly double over the last 3 years, anyway? But orthodox types find this a comforting explanation. Another popular theory among elites is that unemployment benefits are too generous, encouraging the jobless to sit back and live large on $307 a week, the size of the average check. So if we cut benefits, they'll scurry back to work. This is vicious nonsense, but orthodox types find this one, too, a comforting explanation. The Congressional Budget Office is just out with a study of who gets what from unemployment benefits. They found, among other things, that just under half the unemployed drew benefits in 2009. Of those that did, the average recipient collected $6,000 over the course of the year, accounting for 11% of their family's income. That is not living largely, but that 11% does translate into about a month and a half's worth of income over the full year, which is far from nothing. Without unemployment benefits, the CBO estimates, the poverty rate last year would have been 15.4% rather than 14.3%, more than a full point higher. So you can say that unemployment insurance kept well over 3 million Americans out of official poverty last year. Not next year, though. Speaking of which, I was just looking at some personal income numbers. Most people don't know this, and I didn't know the extent of it until I looked at the figures, but tax cuts and government assistance have offered enormous support to personal incomes during the recession and the weak recovery. For example, the tax share of personal income fell by 3 percentage points over the last several years. Big tax cut, in other words. For that, you can thank last year's stimulus bill. Funny, though, most Americans think that Obama raised their taxes. And what economists call government transfer payments, benefits like Social Security and unemployment insurance, rose from 14% of income before the recession to 18% now. Add that 4-point rise to the 3-point decline in taxes, and you see that household incomes would be about 7% below where they are today without government action. Much of that action coming from the malign stimulus bill. That 7% is nearly a full month's income. Fiscal policy certainly hasn't turned bust to boom, and it could have been a lot more potent if it had been bigger and better designed, but still, without it, we'd be wearing barrels. Meanwhile, the increasingly Murdochized Wall Street Journal had a piece the other day pointing to the states as a model for Washington on how to do budget cutting. The news pages of that paper move further rightward by the day, which is a sad thing because the journal used to be a real treasure. States are taking tough measures, partly because they have to. Most are required to balance their budgets, and none of them want to raise taxes. And the measures they are taking are mean and ugly. Over the last 3 years, 29 states have raised fees on or cut benefits for the elderly and disabled. States have also been cutting aid to local governments, which means they in turn have to cut benefits and services. A model the journal pointed to is Indiana, whose Governor Mitch Daniels is a likely Republican presidential candidate. He's balanced his state's budget by ending collective bargaining rights for state employees, cutting $150 million from aid to colleges and universities, by hacking away at assistance to foster parents and the developmentally disabled. But since this is the USA, where meanness is often admired as strength of character, Daniels is a popular figure in Indiana. What a country. And now, a bit more Pacifica Arcana, for which I apologize, but that's only the taking off point. WBAI, the New York station where this program ran for 15 years until the interim program director decided to cut its frequency, has brought back health guru Gary Null to do a daily noontime show. Null was fired several years ago because of a personality conflict with an earlier program director, Bernard White. Null really made the phones ring at pledging time, and his departure was financially damaging to WBAI, so presumably bringing him back will make the phones ring again, since they've been pretty quiet lately. Maybe, but at a considerable price to reputation and decency. WBAI helped make Gary Null both famous and rich. He is much admired by many. He strikes me as a classic snake oil salesman with an unctuous manner and a selfless self-presentation that is actually a mask for a raging egomania. But that aside, Null, like many health freaks, is an HIV denialist. That is, he denies that HIV is a cause of AIDS and that AIDS is a contagious disease. He said recently on the radio show on another station that everything about AIDS is a lie. It's a fraud being perpetrated. That's a direct quote. That sort of talk really excites the credulous, for sure. He also counsels against the use of modern antiviral therapies, without which legions of AIDS patients would be dead. So no matter what you think of the rest of the naturalist armamentarium, this sort of advice can kill people. That may be a rude thing to say, but it's true. Telling people that AIDS is not a communicable disease and that antiviral therapies do more harm than good can kill people. I've got personal experience with two of the healers Null has had in his show. One was the late Dr. Emanuel Revisi, who died in 1998. My uncle, who was dying of advanced prostate cancer, was brought to Revisi by his wife, my mother's sister. Revisi saw him for 5 minutes, handed him 3 unlabeled vials of fluid, and billed him for $500. My uncle took the stuff and died a short while later. The other experience, my father, who was then about 80, consulted another of Null's healers because of some arthritis-like pains he felt in his knee. The healer diagnosed my father with cytomegalovirus infection and prescribed a round of intravenous vitamin C infusions at $100 a pop. CMV infections are ubiquitous. Over 90% of Americans aged 80 and over carry the virus. And vitamin C is very cheap. The healer's markup must have been in the order of 50 times. These two characters are nothing but quacks in a very profitable line of business. But I promised this wouldn't be another Inside Pacifica story, so now on to the larger point. I don't doubt that there are all kinds of therapies and practices in the alternative realm that are useful and less toxic than the orthodox kind. But these need to be tested rigorously, with full disclosure of the contents of the elixirs and the results of their application. Now the likes of Null circulate their propaganda through self-reported testimony with no outside check on veracity. Those who died, like my uncle, aren't called upon to be guests. And this gang of alternate health types tap into the suspicions of the dominant discourse so prevalent on today's left and in the broader counterculture, a reflexive skepticism that's as anti-intellectual as the reflexive credulity of so many in the mainstream. Why is this sort of thing so popular? As I was thinking about this, the phrase modern big-time irrationality popped into my head. It comes from a great essay by the German philosopher T.W. Adorno on astrology, specifically the astrology column in the Los Angeles Times that Adorno read while he was in exile in that city during World War II. And it turns out that something of Adorno's analysis of mass-produced occultism bears on the popularity of quackery. Adorno pointed out that mass consumption of an astrology column is a lot different from classical astrology, which emerged before astronomy was codified as a science, and even today lives on in the form of custom readings done by professionals. Astrology today also coexists in a world where astronomy is a real science, and so it requires a serious degree of intellectual retrogression among the faithful. People should, in other words, know better. But one reason they don't is because so much of what goes on in the name of rationality is actually opaque and irrational, the worlds of technology and money which leave most people dazed and confused. So in some sense, the fascination with astrology and other forms of occultism are an escape from a world of well-compensated expertise from which most people are excluded. But the escape reproduces the patterns of a larger society even more irrationally. People accept the declarations of the astrology column, insofar as they accept them. There's often a note of irony and self-teasing, as one cites the day's capsule summary. They accept this as a form of abstract authority. The syndicated astrologer becomes just another kind of disembodied expertise. I think something similar is going on with the appeal of alternative health gurus. People are confused by actual science and repelled by its debasement by the pursuit of money. Everyone knows how drug companies taint research and medical practice is distorted by fee maximization. So to escape that unpleasant reality, connoisseurs of quackery embrace the critique offered by the likes of Null, who confidently declare that the official line on AIDS is just a fraud. In that, they can sound like climate change denialists who think the whole story of warming is a fraud perpetrated by academics. But the appeal of Null and Company is one of pure authority. The word of the guru takes the place of rigorous evidence. Because for all the corruptions of science, it does depend on the disclosure of techniques, reproducibility of results, and the scrutiny of peers. Yes, there's a lot of authority behind the scientist in the white lab coat, but there's also a lot of rigor. There's none in the alterna world. Still, there's plenty of money-making going on, but the adherents never question that. Okay, back in a moment to talk about green jobs. That was some of Cat Power doing Wild as the Wind, originally performed by Johnny Mathis back in 1957, covered most famously by David Bowie in 1981. And now to green jobs, which are supposed to help get us out of the recession, generate long-term growth, and save life on Earth as well. Not much of that looks to be happening. For an investigation of why, here's an interview with Monica Potts, associate editor of the American Prospect, and author of a cover story in the current issue of that magazine on the topic. Welcome, Monica Potts. Give us first some idea of the dimension of a national training effort for the so-called green jobs, which seem like a promise at the end of the rainbow almost.
Sure. Well, first I can tell you that the stimulus package contained $500 million in Department of Labor grants that went to various workforce training initiatives to train people for specifically for green jobs. And a lot of those were for things like becoming a wind technician or working in a wind turbine manufacturing plant. Some of them went to training people in construction jobs that had green components, training on how to weatherize homes, stuff like that. But I have talked to different workforce development people, and besides the programs that got some of that $500 million in grants, just about every community college in the country, and there are more than 1,000, has either planned or is planning some sort of training program that would qualify as a green job training program.
All right. Who is entering these programs? So these people have been displaced, young people just getting started out. Who's getting trained for the green jobs that may or may not exist?
It's a really big combination, actually. It's probably pretty evenly split between just about every demographic. It's people who have been out of the workforce for some time, people who've been laid off from more traditional blue-collar jobs like manufacturing or construction. Some of them are younger people just out of college just out of high school or recently out of high school. So it's a big mix. But the focus has been on retraining workers who might be losing jobs as a result of the loss of manufacturing in the country over the past several years. It definitely is designed to be a new source of blue-collar job training.
The promises of these would be good, high-wage jobs of the sort that the manufacturing sector used to offer but doesn't really much anymore.
Yeah, that's the idea, that these are good, stable jobs for people who might not have a bachelor's degree or maybe even a high school diploma, who through minimal training can you know, get these jobs and keep them forever. That's the idea.
And the sales pitch that was that this was supposed to provide economic stimulus, employment, at the same time it saved the planet.
Exactly, that it was really a multifaceted, problem solver, that we could revitalize the American manufacturing sector at the same time that we created a new economy that stopped pollution and helped us curb our contributions to climate change, and also have a stable growth sector for the economy in years to come, because the need for this would seem to probably grow.
And now, how are things working out? Are there jobs when people graduate from these programs?
Well, there are some jobs for some people, but it's not quite matching up the way that people wanted. There are definitely some programs that work well, but they stay really small and really realistic. So I spoke to people who ran a program in Michigan, but they train about 15 people a year, and most of the people they place out of state, and some of them they even place out of the country. So for the most part, these jobs really aren't here in the kind of numbers that we see, and just about we would want to see. And just about everyone I talked to said really that the cart's been before the horse, that we're training people for jobs, especially, and there's been a surge this year as schools started to compete for the Department of Labor grant, that we're training a lot of people, but the wind industry especially has had a lot of a year of struggle. And so really the number of people that we're training is outpacing the number of jobs that we might have down the road. The bigger problem, too, is that we don't really have a lot of good numbers on, you know, how many green jobs there are or really even what a green job is. That is something that the government is still working to define, is what constitutes a green job, and trying to count the numbers of what we have and what we'll really see. States have been sort of doing that, those kinds of tabulations on their own, and each state has different standards that, for what counts and, you know, what we would call a green job or not.
Now, speaking of the states, you mentioned that the primary funder of this was the $500 million in the stimulus package from last year, but are the states themselves, do they have any initiatives on this kind of training as well?
Some states do. They've been competing for federal dollars for these kinds of things for a while as well, so even if they aren't getting stimulus money specifically, the federal government has been working to try to fund these things as through other programs as well for a while. And states are also really trumpeting these as, a way to create jobs, especially states in the Rust Belt where jobs are declining. This is a favorite thing that politicians like to point to say that they're doing something for the future to create jobs, and that's training workers for a new field. They also have, and also a lot of community colleges are doing a lot of these things on their own as well.
You mentioned the wind industry is just not taking off as one would have hoped. What's keeping it back?
Well, the wind industry says, and people who analyze the industry agree with them, that what's really happened is that we haven't created a stable consumer market for wind energy. Wind industry has been going, but it's growing, but in kind of a boom and bust cycle for several years. So what will happen is that every few years the federal government will get interested in promoting wind industry and put a lot of money into it. But because fossil fuels still are really cheap and there's no incentive to change over either on the individual level or on the broader utility level, that the consumers really just aren't there. So they might get a boost some years when the economy is doing well and some state somewhere passes a new regulation or a new incentive program, but then either those programs end or people decide they want to save more money and go back to cheaper fuel sources. So there's not really a stable consumer market, and that's really because we don't have the policies in place to try to get us off of fossil fuel-based sources of energy.
So these sorts of industries are not going to take off on their own, right? They need some help.
No. Yeah, they definitely need help. And when you look, when Pew did a report and looked around the world, and the countries that do well are the countries that just put a massive amount of government investment in renewable energies. And that's because they're new, the technology still isn't quite there, and it's just too unstable for private investment to really be drawn in. But that was also true of coal and oil as well. Those two industries get massive government subsidies, and they did from their inception, they really need help and they need some sort of assurance from the federal government going forward to grow steadily.
Now, there's also a lot of talk of retrofitting buildings, weatherizing them more effectively as an employment creator and also an energy saver. How's that going? Anything happening there?
Well, I do think that effort is probably going better and more smoothly, although it would be helped by stronger energy policies to promote it. But definitely the people I spoke to for my piece said that that was the step in between the old carbon-based industry and a new renewable energy source, between us relying on carbon-based fuels and relying on renewable energy industries. But the problem has been so far, again, that we really don't have the incentives for people, the economic incentives for people to weatherize their homes. They will save money over time, but it's a bigger upfront investment, and then you have to count the savings over the years. And so that could take a long time for individuals to recoup that savings. There are some programs meant to spur that, and there was money in the stimulus package to help low-income homeowners and low-income multi-resident units to weatherize, but even those were kind of slow to get off the ground because it was short-term funding again, and so states were wary of hiring people that they would have to lay off a year down the road, so that got a slow start as well.
There are also some tax credits in the stimulus bill for putting in better windows and such, too, weren't there?
There were. I mean, there definitely are financial incentives, but tax cuts, again, don't reach, they only reach down to the middle class. They don't reach down to people who, they're not refundable. So, again, we probably have a lot of low-income people in the country who would benefit a lot, or even people slightly above what we would call low-income who just aren't upper middle class, who would benefit from making these changes, but they just don't have the money up front and they can't rely on tax credits to be able to save money for them. It's just not enough of an incentive. They might just need cash up front or some other kind of more direct break.
Now, there was, for a while, what looked like a hopeful political coalition of unions and environmental groups, you know, the Blue-Green Coalition, to push for these kinds of green jobs. What's happening on the political side?
Well, on the political side, I mean, you know, environmental groups really needed unions because they have more sway in Congress, especially in the House. And that alliance did work to pass that comprehensive bill in the House, but it didn't work in the Senate. And what we are starting to see happening is that, you know, the concern over jobs is going to really draw the union groups away from that, and environmental groups aren't going to want to kind of compromise on any climate change legislation either. So I think we're going to start to see that coalition break up a bit because Americans need jobs now. It's really clear that the wind industry isn't quite ready to hire that many people. The solar industry, I think we've pretty much given up on trying to make solar panels here. We just don't do it hardly at all. And installing solar panels isn't going to employ a ton of Americans. So what you start to see is union members promoting things that environmentalists wouldn't like nuclear energy, and you're going to start to see the focus on jobs kind of draw them away, unless we can get another comprehensive climate bill sometime soon, which probably isn't going to happen.
Now, you mentioned this earlier, but you know, people like to talk about competitiveness a lot, but this whole economic sector of green technology is something where the United States could have some promise, but is actually falling quite badly behind the rest of the world, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I think that's what is concern for people who care about this issue a lot. At some point, America will have to switch its energy source. I mean, it just is unsustainable to continue to use fossil fuel-based sources of energy. But what really depends on good policy now is how much American workers and American families benefit from that shift. The innovators and the people who really start to make these things early and gain competitive advantage are the ones who are going to benefit in the future when it's just undeniable that we have to switch to different energy sources. But whether or not that is in America, whether any American companies or American workers benefit from that shift, really depends on getting the kinds of right policies now.
And I'm guessing the new configuration of Congress will be even less friendly than the previous one to this sort of initiative, right?
Absolutely. I mean, House Republicans now say that they want to investigate whether climate change is really happening or whether it's a fraud perpetuated by academics. So, you know, if that's where we're going back to, I don't see this Congress being more amenable to actually creating meaningful climate change legislation.
So is there any way we can be hopeful about anything, or just get prepared for the water to climb up around our ankles?
I think it's get prepared. I don't know. I'm reporting this story. I got increasingly down about it, but I think I do think that the idea that I think promoting the idea of energy independence and American competitive advantage might work for the American people to get on board with this, but I'm not sure they'll be able to really convince Congress to act.
Yeah, is there any way to get that sort of thing going without a combination of federal spending and regulation?
I don't think so, no.
That was Monica Potts, associate editor of American Prospect and author of a cover story in the current issue of that mag on the failure of green jobs promised to deliver. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back in a minute after a musical break. That was Alfred Brendel doing some of the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 29. Yannis Varoufakis has become a frequent guest in this show because he can talk well not only about the crisis in his homeland, Greece, but also about the wider Eurozone. Varoufakis, a professor of economics at the University of Athens, has a piece in MR Zine, the webzine published by the venerable Monthly Review, called A Modest Proposal for Overcoming the Euro Crisis. Yannis Varoufakis. Welcome, Yannis. Just as we were about to record this, it was reported that Austria is not satisfied that Greece is being austere enough and may withhold its contribution to a Eurozone loan to your country. What do you make of this?
Astonishment. And the reason why I'm saying this is because, let's suppose that everyone agreed with Austria and the tranches were not released by anyone, and Greece was denied this installment in its loans from the IMF and the Eurozone. Now, what would happen tomorrow? Tomorrow, we would have the beginning of a domino effect that would see the collapse of the bond market again throughout Europe. And within a week, no more than that, we would have the collapse of the Eurozone. What exactly is going on? It's very hard to know. It's just that the only precedent we've had, at least in my mind, correct me if there is another one, Doug, is 1929. A major crash occurred, and then the common currency of the time, the gold standard, began to flake, and then eventually to crumble, and then to slash and burn. And it seems to me that the euro is in very dire straits at the moment, as an international, transnational project.
A lot of times watching the Eurozone crisis, I'm reminded of the New York City fiscal crisis of the mid-70s, which in many ways was the beginning of the neoliberal era, end of the social democratic Keynesian compact, such as it was in the U.S., and the onset of the neoliberal crackdown that would go global in the 1980s. But in resolving that crisis, the holders of short-term bonds had to exchange their paper for longer-term securities. They got the union pension funds to buy some city bonds, too. There was austerity imposed on the city, and a committee of bankers essentially took over the city's government. But what was impressive about the arrangement, from the bankers' point of view, was that they got the austerity they wanted, but the bondholders took something of a hit, and they kept everything from crashing down. Is there not that sort of rationality or orderly governance prevailing in the Euro creditor class now?
I'm loath to say anything nice about the creditor class, but I think I have to, because I don't think it's their fault. I think that the creditor class in Europe would welcome restructuring of the kind that you just described. They would love it if the Eurozone, the ECB, whoever, the powers that be, went to them and said, look, guys, you're holding all these bonds that you're really worried about because they're bonds by Greece and Ireland and Portugal, and you're worried, well, and you have good reason to do so, that you may never get your money. And the result is that you don't lend anything, and you are on a drip feed from the European Central Bank, and your banking sector is in a mess. So suppose we were to say to you that you're going to restructure, you're going to accept longer bonds, perhaps even take a haircut, but in response, we promise you, the European Central Bank, that we will keep drip-feeding you until there's some genuine economic growth back in Europe. I think that if bankers were told that, they would have a party instantly to celebrate. The problem is not with them. The problem is the politicians do not have the capacity either to recognize that this would be the obvious solution or to find a way of overcoming their own petty little political projects that are preventing them from doing so.
Extending the New York City example, the New York State government exercised some authority in forcing the parties to come to some sort of deal. Is part of the problem in Europe that there's no superior authority to bang heads together and force a resolution?
Well, of course, it's an institutional lacuna there. But nevertheless, they do manage to get together and to reach important deals and important agreements. For instance, the creation of a 750 billion euro facility for helping fiscally challenged countries like Greece back in May, it was no mean feat. So if they want to, if things reach a certain point of urgency, then they can do it. The problem here is that the conflicts and the conflicts of interest within countries like Germany, like France, like Italy, and between them are such that the political will escapes them.
We've been talking in general terms, but just who are the creditor interests in Europe now? What countries and what social groups within those countries?
Well, if you look at the banking sector, I would say that about half of the Greek debt is owed to German, French, and Dutch banks, with a little bit of British involvement in that. The Financial Times have produced a very nice interactive map where you can drag your cursor on top of it and find out exactly who owes what to whom. What you get is a picture of major interconnectedness, but at the same time, there is a clear view that emerges, and that is that most of the debt of the problematic countries is owned by French, German, and Dutch banks, and they're in serious trouble because of that. And the two crises, the crisis in the banking sector and the sovereign debt crisis, are feeding off each other, with the European Union insisting on concentrating only on the debt and ignoring the banking sector difficulties, the result being that the crisis is dragging on, it's metamorphosizing, it's moving from one realm to the other, and with every transition it makes, it accelerates and continues to become an ever-increasing threat for the whole of the Eurozone.
We've talked about this before, but I keep returning to thinking about it. Is it mostly ideology that's driving the austere policies coming out of the European core, or is there some material interest in driving the continent's periphery into depression?
Oh, there is certainly material interest. Look at Germany. Germany has succeeded in taking its corporatist model to a higher level than it ever has been in the past. They went through a crisis themselves from the 1990s onwards, and German capital managed to subdue the German trades unions to convince them to reduce the size of the pie that goes to labor, increase the percentage of the pie that goes to capital, and to have a kind of redistribution of the smaller pie within the working class, and that had a good effect in the sense that there was a silver lining to that, and that is that they managed to reduce unemployment and keep it low after the 2008 collapse. The problem here is this, that German capital is extremely jealous of its success, because it is a triumph for German capital. In the last 10, 15 years, it has increased its share of the pie significantly with the consent of the trade unions. They really do not want to see this jeopardized. The German worker, manufacturing worker, service sector worker, is experiencing a loss of heart because of a decline, increasing hours of work, increasing intensity of work, and a declining real wage, a declining standard of living. And it is very hard for the German worker to understand why this is happening, while at the same time, the way it is presented to them in the media, the German state has to bail out countries like Greece, you know. So it's a beggar thy neighbor within the working class, and there is a class conflict interest between different classes within the same country.
The EU has been pressing Ireland to accept some sort of big bailout package, but Ireland is refusing. The country is fully funded for another 6 or 8 months, and so it feels it doesn't really need to return to the bond market imminently. So why are the politicians and creditors trying to force a rescue package on a country that says it doesn't need it?
Well, Ireland has good reasons to resist. Firstly, there is a hidden agenda to privatize and sell off to foreign banks its problematic banks, and the Irish are a bit, hesitant about that. But beyond that, the rates at which they are offering them loans from the facility that is available to them, and which was created last May in order to assist countries like Greece, Ireland, Portugal, the interest rates are not very good at all. In my estimation, it would come down to borrowing at 7% at a time when banks borrow at 1%, and Ireland can find funding in the bond markets, even though they are usually rate at 9%. Ireland would like to weather the storm until June, because it doesn't need to borrow until then, and see if it can find better rates by then. 7% is a very high rate, especially in view of the fact that if you accept a bailout, this kind of loan from the IMF, the Eurozone, at 7%, then you're stuck with that 7% for the foreseeable future, even if rates fall in the bond markets. So Ireland has its reasons. Now, why is the European Union, the Eurozone, forcing its hand to accept this kind of assistance? Well, it's because the Eurozone is in a state of panic, because they're worried about a domino effect. Because what's happening in Ireland now is inflaming the spread, the interest rates that Portugal must pay. And Portugal can't wait until June. It must borrow very, very, very quickly in the next few weeks in order to service its existing debt. Spain is waiting around the corner with bated breath as to what's going to happen to its capacity to keep on borrowing. And I tell you, the big bomb that may blow up in our face is Italy. Italy has a humongous public debt. And even though the interest rates are quite low at this time for Italy, I wouldn't be surprised if the Eurozone apparatchiks are particularly worried about what happens if this contagion reaches Italy. Because if it does, then the Eurozone does not have enough money to salvage all these states. And therefore, in order to prevent this from happening, they're forcing Ireland's hand to accept assistance now in order to steady the nerves of the market and to prevent this kind of contagion from going on.
Austerity is clearly not working on its own terms. We're seeing that Irish and Greek bond rates are soaring, and even Britain's as well. And Britain, that's a country that's imposing an austerity program, but hasn't yet slipped into the kinds of deep recessions that the other countries have seen. So all the budget cutting and layoffs and tax increases aren't producing tranquility in the bond markets that the architects of the plans had hoped for. Do you see any sign that the core is rethinking its strategy?
No, I see no sign of that whatsoever, and this is the greatest source of worry that I can think of. It seems to me unbelievable that they thought that by announcing these austerity measures, they would be steadying the nerves of the markets. When you announce an austerity drive, you have to give targets at the same time as to what effect that austerity drive will have on your deficit. So we have targets for the deficit here in Greece, in Portugal, in Britain. The problem with austerity measures is, of course, especially in large economies, especially in the recessionary times, immediately they choke off economic activity. the moment business people start hearing talk of austerity, they go on an investment strike. That investment strike means that there is a dearth of demand, aggregate demand, and this feeds into a lower tax take sooner or later. So when you announce this austerity drive, what you should know is that the target that you announced in terms of the deficit is not going to be met. Now, what effect is this going to have on markets? The opposite of what you want. The question is, why do they do it? Are they seriously thinking that it would work, in which case it's a case of pure idiocy? Or are they differently motivated? I think they're differently motivated. I don't think they're stupid people at all.
What are the motivations then?
Well, look at the Tories in Britain. The Tories in Britain are a seriously revanchist party. They've always, since at least the mid-1970s, late 1970s, they have been steadfastly pursuing policies that would reduce state expenditure on people who the Tories do not consider to be of their own ilk. They do not like seeing poor people getting benefits in order to find work or to stay unemployed without dying. They don't like to see people getting social housing. They don't like the National Health Service. They don't like seeing poor students going to universities at the taxpayers, as they put it, expense. And they will do anything it takes in order to curtail those benefits. And I think the fact that they inherited the government from Gordon Brown at a time of a ballooning budget deficit, which, by the way, happens only because the City of London was paid enormous sums of money. A whole GDP went, extra GDP went to the salvage of the City of London. They seized upon this opportunity in order to do what they always wanted to do, and that is to cut down on the welfare state.
I'm Sukath Yanis Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at the University of Athens. Okay, let's turn now to your idea of how to do things better, the modest proposal that you wrote up for MR Zine. How would you go about resolving this crisis more sensibly and more humanely?
Well, it's a very simple proposal, really, and it comprises of two parts. The first part aims at stabilizing the situation. When you're in the middle of a crisis, when your house is burning down, the first thing you need to do is call the fire brigade to come and extinguish it. So that's the first part. This is a stabilization part. And then the second part concerns rebuilding, recovery. What do you do in order to assist the recovery to the end, to create safety valves and a safety system which will ensure that the crisis will not happen again? So let's take these two steps one at a time. The first step, how do you stop this crisis, this contagion that we just described about? A moment ago. Well, I think that, as I said before, this is a debt crisis, but it's also a banking crisis, which is becoming a real economy crisis. So you have two manifestations of the crisis. And what you need to do is you need to attack them both at once. So the first suggestion is that instead of having bilateral discussions and negotiations between the center being the European Union, the Eurozone, the ECB, the IMF, this is one pole, and a problematic state like the Greek one. Instead of having these bilateral negotiations that end up with an austerity drive in the particular country that gets nowhere, instead of having that, the proposal is very simple. Bring together the representatives of all high deficit countries, countries like Greece, Ireland, Spain, Italy, and so on. Okay, that's one pole. Of course, the ECB and the Eurozone, that's the second one, but also representatives of all main European banks holding the majority of the high deficit countries' bonds and force upon them an agreement. I think we said that before. That would reduce the total amount of debt, and it would steady the nerves of the markets, and it would steady the nerves of the bankers who are now owed sums that they have more or less written off. They don't think they will ever get it because they know that the austerity packages imposed upon the countries through these bilateral negotiations will not work. That's the basic idea. At the same time, you need, in order to stabilize things, you need the equivalent of fiscal policy. Now, we don't have a U.S. Treasury here to run a stimulus package, which we never really had in Europe. But what we do have, Doug, we have something called the European Investment Bank, which, you know, is the size, in terms of its funding capacity, is twice the size of the World Bank. And it can unleash funds to deficit regions of Europe for the purposes of investing in productive activities, not giving loans to laggards, that will steady the fall in the level of investment and in economic activity. That's in the short term. In the longer run, once the freefall has been arrested and the economy, the European economy, is stabilized, what we need is to redesign the euro in order to ensure that it's to enable recovery and to ensure that in the future these crises do not pose such a huge threat to the whole architecture of the euro. And the idea here is very, very simple. The first thing I would do is create EU bonds, like you have U.S. Treasury bills in the United States. We can have you see, one thing that most people don't understand, they don't know, is that the European Union has zero debt. The European Union has zero debt. Its member states have debt. The European Union doesn't have any debt. It's very attractive for investors around the world to have the prospect of buying EU-issued bonds, which they can be used in order to replace, let's say, 60% of the sovereign debt of all the member states could be converted into European Union bonds. And that would be costless, and the interest rate that would be payable by all the member states would then be much lower. Secondly, you would have a situation where the European Investment Bank, that I mentioned a moment ago, is authorized to embark on large-scale investment throughout Europe perpetually. Green technologies, efficiency enhancement, infrastructure, poverty reduction, urban renewal, all these things are things that the European Investment Bank can invest in. It has the capacity, it has the remit to issue its own bonds. And also, at the moment, a percentage of this funding has to come from member states. Well, this could come from European Union bonds if they are created. Now, the combination of the stabilization process that I described with this very simple change in the architecture of the euro, with the creation of European Union bonds, would change the scene and it would have the capacity to create the circumstances that would lead to recovery for the European continent. And the beauty of this proposal, and the reason why we call it a modest proposal, is this. It doesn't really need any major constitutional treaty changes. All the ingredients of bringing about this change are in place. The European Investment Bank is in place. The European Central Bank is in place. All we need is to allow, firstly, for a rational agreement between the center, the member states, particularly the deficit member states, and the European banks, in order to stabilize the economy. We don't need constitutional changes for that. And then we need to empower the European Central Bank to issue the equivalent of United States Treasury bills, and by which to fund recovery and future growth and social cohesion in Europe.
The proposal that you're outlining, aside from its economic dimensions, would also promote greater political cohesion in Europe, which is rather lacking now, right?
Exactly. It would set the scene without being maximalist. Because, you see, now, I mean, I understand entirely and fully that if any political leader canvasses federation, it would have absolutely no luck whatsoever. But we don't need any major change. We don't need to go towards federation in order to create an effective Eurozone structure that will surreptitiously, without us even realizing it, bind together the disparate regions of Europe and the disparate countries of Europe into something much more cohesive than we have at the moment, and effectively reinvigorate democracy, because the average European has lost trust in the capacity of European democracy to create the circumstances for progress in the future.
This proposal sounds classically Keynesian. It's a little redistributive, it centers on public investment, and put some of the burden of adjustment on the creditor countries, those running big surpluses with the outside world, which is something that Keynes thought should be a feature of a global financial architecture that emerged after the end of World War II, but didn't. But that makes your proposal seem like something out of its time. Keynesianism had a brief vogue in 2009, but now looks to have gone out of fashion again as we return to the 19th century. Is there any political support for your kind of approach?
Well, it's funny you should say that. My experience over the last month or so, whenever I have been canvassing that proposal, I'm surprised to find that there is almost a consensus of support emerging in any audience that I have been honored to address. And the support is widespread, and it comes from the left and comes from the right. And I think that the reason why we have this kind of response is because we are in the middle of freefall, of a crisis which we've only seen before in the 1930s. And I think that if you and I lived in the early 1930s, we would have embraced that kind of Keynesian response, even though we would have our deep fears about what would happen, even if that response is adopted. No one benefits from a perpetuation of a major crash. Only fascists do, I think.
Is there a third alternative, something besides what you propose, which is sensible and humane, but hardly revolutionary? Something besides that and the austerity prescriptions coming from the Orthodox, which is leading to deflation, depression, and a possible breakup of the Eurozone. Is there some other way out of this?
No, I sincerely think that there is no alternative. I think that if we don't go down a road similar to this, to the one that I outlined, the euro is going to break up. I don't know what will happen once it breaks up. I don't think anyone is going to be particularly happy once it does. But I can't see any alternative to that, with a possible exception, if there is a miracle worldwide and growth picks up in the United States significantly, and it does so in the rest of the world. If that happens, then it would be possible for the Eurozone to be dragged out by external forces of its desperate situation. But then all that will happen is we will buy time until the next economic downturn, because every time there is a significant downturn, the euro structure proves its incapability of absorbing the shocks.
Finally, some of my more radical friends think that the countries in crisis like Greece should just pull out of the euro and pursue a more nationalistic, autarkic economic strategy, something like Argentina did earlier this decade. What do you think of this approach?
I wish I could agree. Argentina is a special case. Argentina is doing relatively well because, firstly, it didn't have a choice. There was no way it could stay within the environment it found itself in up until the year 2000. The reason, however, it's doing well is because it is a major primary goods producer and it has been attached to China. China is saving countries like Brazil and Argentina, and is creating completely new circumstances and new opportunities of growth. Greece is not a primary good producer, and of course, Greece is in the euro. The tragedy of being in the euro is that it's a little bit like the last line in Hotel California. You can check out any time you like, but you can never leave, if you recall the song. We can't leave, and technically we can't leave. Let's say that the Greek government wanted to get out of the euro. How does it do it, technically? What happens with the euro that I have in my pocket and in my bank account? They cannot confiscate it, and they cannot forcibly convert it to whatever new currency we end up having here in Greece, the drachma, I suppose, or a new drachma. They would have to violate European Council human rights legislation. And even if they could do that, then I think most people would dash to the bank before the government introduces these changes and remove all their euros, and we would have an economy, a two-speed economy. Most people would be using the euro, a bit like Kosovo. Kosovo is using the euro at the moment, even though it's not a member of the euro, of the eurozone, will become a protectorate if something like this happens. So what I would say to your radical friends, it's what I say to my radical friends who say similar things to me, is that if this were 1999 and we had a referendum, should we get into the euro or not, I would have voted against. But once you're into the euro, there are non-linearities. You can't get out and expect to find yourself in the place you were once.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, and that's not the way you say it in Greek, but the correct pronunciation eludes me, a professor of economics at the University of Athens. Check out his piece, A Modest Proposal for Overcoming the Euro Crisis, published in Monthly Review's webzine, which you can find at mrzine.org, mrzine.org. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week. Let's go out with this, from a pretty new album by Swans that has the catchy title, My Father Will Guide Me Up a Rope to the Sky. The song is called Reeling the Liars In. If only. Till next week, bye.
Reeling the liars in. We are reeling the liars in. We are removing their face, collecting their skin. We are reeling the liars in. We are burning them in a pile. We are burning them in a pile. The only true thing, the place to begin, is to burn up the liar pile. Now the sun will hide beneath the ridge tonight. Clear flames of revenge will live.